32 rounds of the beats,
a
bit slow. And I was feeling so, I mean, I've been practicing different types of meditation, but I never felt such a really deep experience as I did when I was chanting the mantra and I was just concentrating in the yoga asanas and chanting. And really I was feeling very ecstatic. I don't really have words to describe the different experiences I was going through. That even tears were coming from my eyes, my ears were standing on end. I was really feeling something I never experienced before in all the yoga practices I've been doing for over a year. And so then, after that, I was really convinced it was a very powerful form of meditation. This is, much deeper than anything I'd experienced before. And I came back, and then the devotee told me that by accident he had given me Prabhupada's deeds. The deeds he had chanted on. Maybe that had something to do with it. So I had to put those back. I'm sorry. Anyway, it gave me that boost I needed. Normally we'd only get the beads chanted on by Prabhupada when we get initiated, but somehow I got a special mercy to get them right away. But even after that, I decided to continue. I didn't really keep up my Hatha Yoga practice, but nowadays in many of our temples, like in Pune, every morning they do Hatha Yoga for about an hour, all the residents and regular visitors. A number of temples, they were including Hatha Yoga as a part, at least for giving physical tone and for giving good concentration. But primarily we practice Bhakti Yoga. What we like to do is now we're trying to also understand that I have a disciple who was teaching Hatha Yoga in Hong Kong for about 15 years. And she had also introduced little elements of Bhakti Yoga. Because even in the Hatha Yoga system written by Patanjali, he said that if one wants to get any spiritual advancement, you also have to have the blessings of Krishna. You have to have some devotion, some love, some divine love in order to get that really any spiritual blessings. So many yoga groups don't really teach that, but the spiritual love, that everybody has the same super soul in the heart, that we're all connected, we're all in a very, we're united in many ways, but we don't know how to connect like that. And actually having like Bhagavad Gita tells us, we should have a way of life which is very much in the mode of goodness, like being a vegetarian, like avoiding things which are in the mode of tamas, which make us, put us in depression and anxiety. So have a very favorable, good lifestyle. And then with that, Bhakti Yoga teaches how if you're already doing a good lifestyle, you can just, slight changes, you can make it a pure good lifestyle, you can make it a divine lifestyle. Just like we eat vegetarian food, but if you offer the food to the mantras and to Krishna, then it becomes a spiritualized food. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says that we can liberate ourselves from various karmas just by taking spiritual food, which is nothing but vegetarian food that is offered through mantras and devotion. So very simple things can be done to transform our yoga practice into something much more spiritual, which also would give us much more empowerment to help other people, much more contact with our inner self, with our real self, and contact with the Supreme Self. So the fact that you're becoming yoga teacher, so we hope that in Atman Yoga, we hope that you can to not only be very expert in Hatha Yoga, which is now, I mean, I had to do, I went back to Hatha Yoga because traveling around the world, about 10 years ago, I pulled out my back and I went to the, they had an MRI and checked everything, and they said, showed it to the different doctors, and one doctor said, you're going to have to operate on you, you got a slip disc. And then went to another allopathic doctor, and he said that, well, but I put you in 17 days of traction because your nerve is being pinched in your back. And I went to another doctor, so 11 days of traction and some therapy because then he gave some other thing, the disc is just about to slip. And they all had some different idea, but they wanted to operate, and there was someone wanted to operate on my back. Then a Hatha Yogi, who used to be a Mr. Universe and before he was a bodybuilder, changed over to yoga. He came and visited me and he said that he had me do the Bhujangasana and I forget another asana, two different asanas. For 20 minutes, all the pain was gone. I was on my feet walking. So then, they wanted to operate on me, they put me in traction. So like in the modern day, if you don't have, if you don't do a little bit of stretches, a little bit of hot yoga, it's very difficult. And they just want to put you on the operating table and cut you up. And within 20 minutes, all the pain was gone. Before I couldn't even turn over. I was in excruciating pain. So then, since then, I've been doing a little minor routine of hatha yoga exercises, but nothing like what you're doing. And very important. I was just in Trivandrum for a South Indian Ayurvedic retreat, and they had a yoga teacher there, just saying that by doing different kinds of yoga, this also helps to activate the organs in the body, the kidneys, the glands. So it's a very practical, both physically and mentally. But then for spiritually, if you add bhakti yoga, it's definitely much more fast acting. So if you combine a little bhakti yoga, then you'll find that there's natural love that we all have. Bhakti means love. And so we want to awaken that love that's within us. And let that be a primal spiritual mover. And this way we can actually make spiritual advancement very, very quickly. We can get a deeper handle on our actual identity. But just hatha yoga in itself, it takes a long time to get a spiritual realization. It's part of the Ashtanga Yoga system, and that system requires a very much ideal environment to actually get into the state of samadhi. But by the mantra chanting, you can get samadhi very quickly. And that's what I experienced the first day when I did the mantra. And it's the fact that you know how to sit properly. Sometimes if you hear, there's a japa tape by Prabhupada, and he was instructing his followers to sit properly when they were chanting. So during the japa session, japa means when we individually chant mantra. Kirtan is when we chant together, and japa is when we chant individually. So there's on the tape where Prabhupada is chanting with his devotees, and the japa says, and at one point he stops and says, sit properly. You heard that? So he wanted us also to learn how to sit properly, how to be in a good posture for our meditation. So since 68, now it's how many years? 39 years. I'm trying to spread the yoga process around the world. We have a number of students who are practicing. I'm trying to encourage people. So right now that the teacher who was teaching in Hong Kong, she's moved over to Australia and she has 268 students there. And so I met some of them this time, just coming now from Australia. A number of them also practicing not only the Hatha Yoga, but also doing a little bit of the Bhakti Yoga with it. And so they're finding a very deeper experience from the whole process. So I'm really happy to meet all of you. Today is a very special day for us. My Guru, it's His Divine Grace, Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. His picture is there in the back. And today is the day He appeared in the world, according to the lunar calendar. So for us, this is called the Vyasa Puja, the day we respect Him and offer homage to Him as the representative of the line of the Siptic succession coming down from over 5,000 years. So you're in a very very special day. I'm very happy to meet you on this day. So, but you said, I think Nandini was suggesting that you might have some questions for me. Okay.
I was wondering if what is the special number 16 rounds a day to chant? Why do you chant 16 rounds? I mean, if you chant less, is it, less spiritual?
Interesting question. Well, actually, some places in the Vedas it says that you chant 100,000 names of Krishna. That is enough to get you back to the spiritual world. So it was really, the really number is 100,000, which would be 64 rounds. But then Prabhupada, when he came to the West, he found that the people are so active and there's so many requirements that he said, if you do a regular practice of yoga, of service, so that you're more or less always staying in the yoga environment, and even 16 rounds should be enough, so that he could guarantee you to get back to Godhead in this one life, to get back to the spiritual world. The idea is that we're all spiritual in nature, and we've been taking so many births here in the material world, but to end the cycle of rebirth, that requires some spiritual focus. So he is saying that if you do 16 and you follow a very good lifestyle, then you can get back in this one lifetime. He would promise that. But I'm a minister in ISKCON for congregational development and community development. So I'm mainly dealing with people that don't live in temples. But anyway, now the number of people living in temples is very less. 99% of all our followers are practicing from their home. So I'm dealing with that. So many people, obviously, they're not able to chant 16 rounds. Some are chanting maybe 8 rounds or 4 rounds. We try to get them to at least chant something as a minimum, because that gives you more of a steadiness in your spiritual progress. It also helps to control the mind. The fact that we make a decision to do something and we actually do it helps us to kind of impose the intelligence over the mind, because the mind otherwise is always kind of calling the shots, telling us what to do. So now we want that the intelligence is closer to the Atma, to the self, than the mind. So using intelligence, you can control the mind. So we advise people to see what they can do as a regular routine. And if it's 1 hour, or 2 hours, or 4, maybe not be a guarantee to go back to Godhead, maybe someone can go back to Godhead also, even with less challenge. But they have to start somewhere. Then later, I find you get more of a taste when you chant more rounds, actually. You get more of an experience. Maybe the first 4 rounds feel a little peaceful. The next 4 to 8, you start to get some energy. Then after the 8 to the 16, you start to actually get a kind of a spiritual taste, a sweet taste in the mouth and in the heart. And start to develop more of an experience, a deeper reciprocation with the chanting. The idea is it's a living mantra. Mantras are living, they're spiritual, they're alive, they're dynamic. I had a situation once where, just when I was newly practicing, then I was working outside in a restaurant. Although my parents and grandparents were very wealthy, but it was kind of an emergency, so I was working in the restaurant. And then the person who was the cook, he suddenly fainted. And so everybody ran to see what to do, how to revive him. At that time I was already chanting, practicing Bhakti Yoga a little bit. And so I didn't know what to do. I went over and I just chanted Hare Krishna in his ear. And then all of a sudden he started shaking. And his eyes opened and sat up. He looked around and said, "Okay, I'm all right." And he asked me, "Can you stay here a second? What is it you chanted?" He said, "See, I have this problem that I astral project. And I left my body and I was, at that time I was in Montreal, Canada, and he had left and he'd gone to Belgium for some reason." Mm. He was just, he was very weak mentally, and somehow his astral body would just go out of his gross body and he would faint. He said, when you chanted this Hare Krishna, I heard, it was like at first I was very far away, like Hare Krishna. But then it got louder and louder, like a reverse echo. Like an echo, you know, starts loud and goes softer and softer. But this was like not dynamic, it was not static, it was dynamic, it was going more and more. It was like Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. So it just like filled my whole pancreas system. Brought my astral body back to my gross body, and then I came back to consciousness. So, which for me was also kind of interesting to know that how this mantra is dynamic, and how it increases in our consciousness and tends to purify our different emotions and different thoughts. So try to, like that, we try to get the establish some minimum chanting that will also build up. Like if you do 16 rounds, it works out to 10 million names of Krishna a year. And Prabhupada's guru, he had also told his followers and those who are like living and just doing like monks in the temple, that he had advised to do 64 rounds and 100,000. But for those who are going out and teaching and doing different activities, he said 16 would be enough. So then Prabhupada just kept up to 16. The 64 is pretty much out of that range for But I also tell people, whatever they can do, just try to pick some minimum number. Mm-hmm. So if you do 4 rounds, it'll be 2.5 million in a year. If you do 8 rounds, it'll be 5 million. It all adds up.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the background. The Hatha Yoga is actually part of the Ashtanga Yoga process, which is an eightfold process, and that includes the asanas, and also that one is doing. Most people don't do the real eightfold yoga. They don't actually do all the practice. Part of it is niyama. There's some rules, and usually the rules aren't all put into it. And niyama yama, controlling, how to control our mind. So even karma yoga, doing services in between the time we're doing the meditation, doing kind of spiritual activities dedicated to God. It's also part of the Ashtanga yoga process. And finally, one goes into dhyana, which is a very deep meditation after pranayama, learning how to see in between the thoughts, how to stop the thought process. So the Hatha Yoga, the Ashtanga Yoga is leading up to sitting down and being very meditative, and through breathing processes and asanas to control the thoughts, and eventually to be able to see between the thoughts. The thoughts come one after another. So when one is able to see between the thought, then one is goes into samadhi, but then one can eventually see the atma, and see the self, and see the paramatma, the super self, and this way. But to actually come to that level requires maybe many, many, many years of practice, and then one can lift up the atma, on the prana, the life airs to the different chakras, and It's a mechanical process where you're actually putting a control of your life areas and moving your atma. And if one doesn't know what they're doing, then sometimes the atma can go out through the eyes or through the nose and you could die. So you really need to have someone who's very expert. And once you start to move your life areas around the body and things like that, so mostly nobody's teaching that level of Ashtanga Yoga, the real level, which is, comes after the 7th and 8th level, where you do dhyana, and then you do samadhi, and then you actually can you can travel to other planets, or you can levitate or do different things. Those type of awakened or mystic powers, those thing, most people, they're not really teaching that level of it. They're just teaching the asanas, mainly a little breathing exercise, but they don't really go that deep into it. Now, bhakti yoga is a ninefold practice, and it's not based on asana, because it's where we use our body in the meditation. For hatha yoga, you want to stop the thought process and control. You can't stop it, but at least you can slow it down to the breathing exercise. And eventually you can stop it by the breathing and see in between the thoughts and be able to go beyond the mind and see the self. But in bhakti yoga, we actually replace the thoughts with the mantra. So we're thinking the mantra. So that's a lot easier. It doesn't take so much time. It's also not dangerous. It's not that we're not mechanically trying to play around with our life airs. We're letting it happen in a kind of a holistic way. It just happens through the meditation. So the first one is we hear Shravanam and Kirtanam, we chant. Smaranam, we remember. So there's nine processes. There's also offering prayers or paying obeisances, bandhanam. There's archanam, there's this worshipping of the Devi as a means of meditation, and the hands-on process where we're seeing that original personality of Godhead. He's a person and he can come in a Devi form, he can worship. That's another kind of meditation. Then there's padasevanam, doing different services. So just like he's cooking for you, but that's also his meditation. That's one of the first meditations I did when I came into the temple in Montreal, was to cook. And it's a wonderful meditation because you're thinking the whole time, you know, I'll be offering this to Krishna, the devotee's going to get this spiritual food, and try to put your love into it, try to do it as a meditation, and then you make an offering to the mantras and the prayers, and then you give everyone the spiritual food. People can actually feel some energy from the food. It's not just an ordinary meal. It's something very special. So that we do different activities like that. It's all called Padasevana, serving the Lord's feet, doing different activities which we offer. Just like I'm coming and talking to you, this is my kirtan. This is speaking about yoga, about Krishna, about bhakti yoga. So this is also a meditation for me. And you're listening, so that's also a meditation for me. So these nine processes of devotional service, so the last three were dasyam, which is to consider oneself a servant of the Absolute, and sakyam, to be a friend with Krishna, to see him as a friend, to be a friend, and to have a deeper communion, a deeper spiritual union with the Supreme Personality. And then finally there's Atmanivedana, which where all our thoughts, words and activities are offered. So even if one does one of these nine processes, one can also achieve liberation. And if you do more, then more the merrier, more the better. So it's not so maybe for the kirtan or for the japa. If you know the Hatha Yoga Prapascha, you can sit longer, you can have a better concentration, but it's not an essential part of Bhakti Yoga, it's a useful part. In Satya Yuga, when it was very peaceful, in former Yuga, everybody used to do the meditation, then they would meditate on the Super Soul in the heart, so their Bhakti Yoga was using the meditational process. It was combined. Hatha Yoga as well as Bhakti was thoroughly combined. As I said, Patanjali said that Bhakti is an essential part even of the Hatha Yoga process, even of the Asana Yoga process. It's what really gets us boosted into the higher realms. If one simply does Bhakti Yoga, it may not be essential to do the Hatha Yoga. But as I said, now probably for health, it's useful. So I'm going back to doing a lot more Hatha Yoga now myself. But I'm not flexible like I used to be, so it's like starting all over again. It was worse than before. But anyway, it's very important just for many more maybe external reasons. But did that answer your question?
That's wonderful. And I also am wondering in the literature if anyone has ever documented the process of starting the chant and then the evolution of that, the impact of that on the person over time. And I know that that is specific to the individual. But I think that it would be beneficial to have a bigger picture of this is the process and these are the impacts that we're experiencing.
There's somebody, Derek Benedict, a thesis on that actually, on the chanting. He took three control groups and did a study on it.
Really?
Yeah. And on the effects of chanting and stress, anger, frustration, all different. And, you know,
I would really like to get those
I have a disciple who's English and he's married to a Danish lady, and he's also done some research on the chanting and how to have a better concentration, how to have a, I don't know exactly the whole realm of all the research he did, but I know he's also done something, and Bhakti Tirtha Swami also encouraged him to write some literature on it, and he wants to set up a chanting institute in Mayapur to get people like they go for retreats and go deeper into the chanting. It could also connect you to him.
That would be great. And actually, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I'm here today to write an informational article for our publication to share. I think this is a brilliant spiritual tool that the chanting, and so I'm really interested in being able to define what it is and the impacts, and to just to better inform so that we have a better understanding of the Hare Krishna movement and the different spiritual methods and tools. I think that I'm so impressed with your defining the mind and the spirit, and the Vedic literature and the Bhagavad Gita is so advanced. I'm so impressed with it, and it's been a wonderful experience to come to the temple and to learn to study the Vedic.
Many years ago, I went to the Salt Lake City, must have been in the 70s, so there are big, maybe late 70s, early 80s, so the big exhibition they had there, and probably still have a big exhibition there, and they took us around. We wanted to go really, you know, kind of get many different presentations. We wanted to go deep into what really was the core philosophy. And so finally we found someone who was able to tell us that that your belief was that there was an original being in the universe, and every universe has one of these original beings, and that he's the creator of the universe, and he has Jesus as the Son, and different aspects like that. And when that actually, so this Hare Krishna movement comes, our yoga system is started by Lord Brahma, who is the original being in this universe. And it was handed down from him. So I thought that we have something in common. We also, it seems like who you were talking about was Brahma, because he's the original personality of the universe. And so he taught us that he handed down the system that we've been following. It's handed down from spiritual master to disciple. This is called the Brahma Matva Gaudiya Sampradaya.
I remember something that we create, especially in the Western world, most of our own misery, and through our mind. And so I'm very excited to learn more about the Eastern body of religious writings, about that we can actually control the mind through these spiritual practices and have to be more centered on God. And especially in this day and time with the advertisements and the materialism, you know, the intense influence of the material world, and if there is a way to bring peace in the midst of all of that. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to meet you and speak today.
my understanding from Atmananda Prabhu is that Atma Yoga is still primarily teaching Hatha Yoga, but also giving some introduction to Bhakti Yoga, some Bhakti Yoga tools that the students could use. So that he's kind of giving a little bit of a synthesis of both aspects. Where, as I said, probably it's a real individual whether interest whether somebody wants to do Hatha Yoga. And what we're mainly teaching in the is Bhakti Yoga. But Atma Yoga is Hatha Yoga and Bhakti is synthesis. So now we're saying that many people like, you know, it's good for their health and good otherwise to have that experience of Hatha Yoga. So that's not the main thing in the normal, say, in the ISKCON or the temple, Hare Krishna temple. So you're getting something of an access to both sides, the essence of Bhakti and the essence of Hatha Yoga. So this gives you some tools with which you can also get the best of both worlds.
One other question. I
have a couple of things. One is, could you talk a little more about the sentence in the mouth that you spoke of earlier, and also the difference between the conversation with the intelligent and the conversation with the mind? I'm not really sure that's an intelligent question, but you spoke of intelligence versus the mind.
When you this is a chanting the holy names, there's different steps you go through, and one of the steps is called ruchi, which is the taste. And sometimes, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he came 521 years ago, before people, in order to get even advanced in Bhakti Yoga, was also a very gradual process. But he's I don't know if we want to use a modern word, he turbocharged it, or he's made it, like put it on the fast track, or he's made it much more accessible to people, because he saw that in this, in the modern era, even 500 years ago, people were becoming more and more materially engrossed with the speaking of today. I mean, those times were much more spiritual than now, in India at least. And so he's, so by chanting his mantra, Before I chant Hare Krishna, I chanted Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadhar, Shri Vasari Gaurabha Kavinda. I don't know, did you learn that one?
Mm-hmm.
So that one really helps to open up everything very quickly. So one can even maybe just get a glimpse of some of these higher levels of bhakti. There's like 8 levels. The first, there's you'll develop your faith in the whole spiritual process, and the second level is you associate with other spiritual people and get the strength from that positive kind of association. And then you start to learn how to practice the different aspects of devotional service. And then you get the next one is to start getting rid of different anxieties and different problems that are in the mind. Then you become very fixed in a spiritual perspective. Then you get the ruchi, the taste, and then you start to get really attached to the spiritual environment. And normally we're very attached materially, but now we can be a little attached spiritually. That will help to balance the things out and help to keep us much more motivated and fixed. And then finally you develop a kind of a spiritual ecstasy called bhava, which may be 8 different symptoms, which could include crying, voice choking up, hair standing on end, laughing uncontrollably, just feeling so much joy coming from your heart, you start to laugh. Let's see, what are some of the other ones? Yawning, for some reason, sometimes there could be an expression of ecstasy. Then becoming stunned, just becoming like frozen and stunned in ecstasy, a voice choking up. I didn't keep track, but I mean, more or less like that, those type of things. And so that's called bhava. So that's on the 8th level. Then when you get actually spiritually realized, then you go to a higher level, which is called prema, which is pure love, which is pure divine love. And bhava is like ecstatic love. So it's kind of all increase of our loving experience. So that's the different levels of bhakti. So by Lord Chaitanya's mercy, sometimes you can see the glimpse of a very higher level, maybe a higher level than you're normally on. And that little experience is kind of like a little window, which is very motivational, that you get a taste for what kind of spiritual bliss was. Then what was the other question, the part of the question? The mind.
Yeah, the intelligence.
Right. Well, in the Bhagavad Gita, it says we have a physical body, then we have the subtle body, which is mind, intelligence, and false ego. Mm-hmm. The ego. But the material ego, then there's a higher spiritual ego, but that's not material. So this, but what happens, the mind is continually thinking, one thought after another. And we don't normally have much control over it. So then the intelligence is what is discriminating. Like someone may step on your toe, or maybe you get an immediate reaction. You think, you know, you get angry, or you, why is this person? You maybe think something negative, but then your intelligence says, cool down, chill out, you know, maybe it was an accident. Or so then you start to discriminate. But the mind may come up with, however we've conditioned the mind, it just comes up with thoughts one after another. And we just get conditioned by our environment, by our associates, by the people we're with, and we start to develop a particular way of thinking. And if we have very good people we're with, then we think in a better way, and if we have very crude people, then we start thinking in a very crude way. But to actually change the way we're thinking, that's part of the bhakti yoga process, is to purify the mind. But that's where the chanting of the mantra, it very quickly starts to purify the mind and helps it to get the control of the mind. Even when we chant mantra, the mind may go off and think of this or that, so we bring it back. That's where chanting out loud helps, because we can bring back the mind. There's three types of chanting: mental, soft, and loud. But the mental chanting is actually more difficult, because when the mind goes off, then the whole focus is, the whole meditation is broken. Where we're chanting audibly, when the mind goes off, the sound will help us to bring the mind back. Usually early in the morning, it's because the mind is less polluted by the newspapers, newscasts, the different interactions we have with people. It's considered a really good time for the mantra meditation. But then we can also meditate anytime. There's no retirement plan rule. Like some people, we tell they're riding to work in the bus or something, or in the subway, they can also chant even while they're riding. So in all the spare moments that we use the mantra, that helps us to bring the mind into a very peaceful, very spiritual frame. And so that way, it helps us to make the intelligence stronger, to help to control the mind. One of the names of Bhakti Yoga is also called Buddhi Yoga. There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita that says, Buddhi Yoga Antam. This is the yoga of intelligence. Because we're using the intelligence to control what we think. Sometimes, like different people are at different stages. Some are actually able to control their thoughts using their intelligence. Some, the mind is so powerful that at certain times you just get maybe the emotions or whatever. The mind is really out of our control, but then because of chanting and because of our spiritual process, we're able to see the mind a little more objectively. Rather than thinking that I am the mind, we see the mind is also one of our senses. It's like a subtle sense. So then we can start to discriminate whether I really want, this is really me, or this is just my reaction because of all my conditioning. And we can start to analyze the thoughts, and we may reject that this is not really what I want to be, this is not the way I want to think, this is not who I am. You know, maybe some anger, or maybe some very violent, or whatever, different kinds of thoughts come in the mind, maybe very envious or jealous, or whatever. So many kinds of thoughts are there that could come in. So sometimes we can distance ourselves. Although the thoughts come, we can say, well, this is not me. I'm not able to fully control it yet. I'm not at that level to fully be able to change my thoughts, but at least I can distance myself that this, I'm accepting this thought. This is who I want to be. This is me, or I can distance myself at this thought. It's not, this represents my previous conditioning, but it's not what I want to be or what I really want to think. And then in that way, we start also to reconditioning our mind and our consciousness. So dealing with it, there's some works about dealing with the mind and how to purify the mind. I wrote a book once, translated a book, actually a commentary of my grandfather Guru's work called Vaishnava Cave, where he's mainly dealing with the mind, how the mind goes through, even in the Bhakti Yoga process. Maybe you get inspired by, you want to get a lot of personal recognition. Maybe people will say you're a great devotee, you're a great yogi. So there could be different kinds of more egoistic types of attachments that come up in the mind, and how to distance, how to recognize those, how to distance ourselves from those, how to come into a more pure spiritual mindset, more filled with love, more filled with caring about others, and not based more on the egoistic interests that are very natural in this material world. So sometimes people want to go in a secluded place to meditate, but not for the right reason. Maybe not because in a secluded place they could meditate better, but because they're thinking that by doing this people are going to think that I'm a very advanced spiritual person, I could go in a secluded place. So I guess he analyzes it from the point of view of different pitfalls that could fall in a bhakti yoga yogi. So I wrote one commentary on that. But dealing with our mind, it's a very mind. The Bhagavad Gita said if we can control the mind, it becomes our friend. And if the mind controls us, it can be our enemy. So this is where the Hatha Yoga helps a little bit to make the mind peaceful, but it's a very difficult tool to actually control the mind. It takes a very long time of Hatha Yoga practice. For Bhakti Yoga, you can control the mind very much in a much more quick manner. That's why using both is very useful. You have your hand up? What's your name? I didn't hear. My name is Jaya Pataka Swami. Jaya is victory, Pataka is flag. The victory flag of Krishna for my gurus told me, so.
Louis.
So Is is also a name of Krishna. Iswara. So you have Krishna in your name, hidden. Iswara. As my hobby, look for Krishna in people's names. So.
So my question is, I guess I'm thinking about this movie that we saw this week.
Which was that?
And it's the one that
the Kumbhamela.
Not the Kumbhamela, but the all of the Western philosophers that have taken a look at the Vedas, like the Transcendentalist Emerson and Schopenhauer. And so do we have minds like that are working with the Vedic philosophy now? I mean, it's sort of, I'm like thinking that there's these treasures in the Vedic. And so is it now time to unearth some of this for the West? And I guess the other part of the question is Western culture ready for a greater expansion
of Krishna consciousness? And it feels like, or maybe this is my wishful thinking, that, it's a time for expansion.
Maybe it's a calling for you.
There are some devotees who, like Hridayananda Maharaj and different who have gone ahead and he's got a PhD from Harvard University Divinity School. People got their doctorates and things, and exactly how they intend to utilize that to the original purpose. They said they went back to college to get the university to get their doctorates was to do something like what we said. But I'm not right on top of the. I mean, there's not a So there's a coordinating group for the scientific research, and that's called the Bhaktivedanta Institute, and they're doing a lot of research more, but more from the scientific point of view, the quantum mechanics and the different aspects of consciousness. They have a accredited university course on consciousness in India. They're doing different things like that, but from a theological or, I don't know, psychological point of view, if anybody's working on it, I know some people, as you said, Vera Govinda did some work. It would be interesting to really do a kind of a census of, or to have some kind of a coordination for that perspective. I know this, I was in Mexico in May, and one of my godbrothers, he said he happened to come across a book in English that where someone, in the 1800s, a theologian went to India researching for Christianity outside of Christ. And he had gone to Gorakhpur. And so this was his experience. And there in one chapter he said that he encountered the history of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he said that he never found any example of someone who was so deeply immersed in divine love, either in the East or the West or anywhere, who was in a constant communion, from his perspective, of course, he was in constant communion with God. He was having discussions in his final pastime with very spiritually elevated people, discussing about the esoteric teachings of the personality of Godhead, and that he was experiencing an ecstasy called Mahabhava, which is, I mentioned some of the ecstatic symptoms. Well, his level of ecstasy was off the radar map. It was like really, I mean, he would really go into very deep ecstasies in his loving communion with Krishna. So somehow this theologian, he had encountered this, and he was saying that this is the greatest thing I've ever found anywhere in East and West, of someone who had developed so much divine love. But it's like, I mean, I never heard about that when I was... So that's like people have come across things like that, but it hasn't really been collated and presented in a very systematic way. That would be very interesting to have. I think there are people. I don't say that everybody is open-minded. A lot of the sectarian way that religion has taken kind of boxes people into their own sect and their own like a little fortress. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in the 1800s, he wrote like this, that the sectarian vision of religion, where people are put themselves in a particular fortress and they're like at war with all the other religions, it's not going to help the human society. There should be much more of an open appreciation of the good aspects of every spiritual path. So he was writing about that in the 1800s. But right now there are people who are open, who are looking at different, taking the best from the different aspects of spirituality and different paths, and there are some people who are very much in their own box and that they don't want to look outside, and anything outside they might think it's like whatever, something sacrilegious or hedonist or whatever, something bad. So yeah, but there are more open people, and that's something that we should see how to have a more of an exchange. I've done a different interfaith programs recently. I was last year in November, I was in Accra, Ghana. We had an interfaith program in West Africa. The Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Church was there, different Muslim, different representatives of different faiths and religions, even one African king over an African nation that spread across four countries. So different people, but usually everybody's kind of defending their own point of view, and I don't know how much you the meeting of the minds are, but we're doing some interfaith. We're trying to reach out and try to share our understanding, but it's interesting. So much more could be done, really, so much more. Even here in Atlanta, there was an initiative by the previous mayor about 10 years or 8 years ago, I forget how many, maybe 7 years ago, where he wanted all the religions to come together and help to deal with the crime and the problems, the social problems. And so Balabhadra Prabhu was a member of that initiative, meeting with all the different religions. So we had some program here where different faiths came and discussed their point of view. And I said, most everybody presents their own point of view. How much they really listen to what the others are saying, I don't know. My mother chants Hare Krishna, but she's also a devout Christian. And so she told me that, she sent me a verse from John's. There she said where Jesus told his followers that, "Don't think you're my only flock. I have many flocks in different parts of the world, many flocks in different places, and you're not my only flock." So then she said, "Wow, I didn't know." Because usually that's not the way, you know, the way the truth. But here he was saying that I had different flocks, different followers, and different ways. So maybe the Hare Krishna's in one of those flocks. Mm-hmm. What's your name?
Hello, my name is Deborah.
Jenora.
Deborah. Yes.
So you also have a spiritual name. Deva.
Yes.
It's the name of Krishna.
I'm a guest of Sandy's. And I would like to compliment everybody because I have just felt so blissful in here the entire time. It has been just wonderful being here. So thank you very much. That said, I would like to ask a silly question because I've traveled all over Asia and I've seen this orange color you're wearing so much. And all the temples are smudged in orange. And I know the Tibetans say when you die, the death room should be orange. Why do you wear the orange color?
Wow. Interesting. Well, we're told that when the sun rises, this is kind of an orange color at the sunrise, where it's very energetic. At the same time, in the morning sun, it's quite peaceful. But this is a kind of a peaceful, dynamic, fiery color. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to symbolize a kind of an active renunciation. That we're dedicating everything in the divine. We do it through dedicating our services in the divine. Some people do it by renouncing the material world. Mm-hmm. There's different ways. So we use the material world as an energy of Krishna, so we use it in his service. But this color is for those who are in a renounced order, like a monk. And that's why the monks, the Buddhist monks, they have different shapes. I mean,
you're
some.
Gorgeous.
Well, we try to keep a little light color, not too dark, not too bold yellow. I mean, not too bold the orange. Something just like that light color of just the sunrise. That's supposed to help us also to be more spiritually oriented. It's supposed to give some energy. Is that okay, Deborah?
Yes, thank you. Good answer.